WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
My guest Barry Lopez won the 1986 American Book Award for Nonfiction for Arctic Dreams, an account of his travels in the far north over a period of 4 years. When Lopez accepted the award, he said, "Even though I appear to write largely about the landscape and animals, what is in my gut as a writer is a concern for the fate of the country I live in and the dignity and morality of the people I live with." Lopez is also the author of the book Of Wolves and Men, a study of wolves and their powerful influence on the human imagination. The book is based on Lopez's travels through Alaska, but he actually raised two hybrid red wolves at his home in the Oregon woods. Although it was an extraordinary experience, he concluded that wolves don't belong living with people. All too often, the wolf's life ends tragically, or its potential for growth is smothered. Lopez has lived in the Oregon woods for 20 years. He grew up in New York City and in the San Fernando Valley. Lopez's latest book is a collection of essays chronicling his travels through North America. I asked him to read the conclusion of his essay, Gone Back into the Earth.
I had just come out of the Grand Canyon with Paul Winter, a musician, and the musicians that play with Paul, and another small group of musicians who had traveled along with us, and several friends and whatnot. And we had had a very deep emotional experience, the group of us together, and then we all went our separate ways. And I was making my last connection to get home, sitting there in the airport in San Francisco, and wondering what really was it that had happened? What is the reverberation of all of this experience that we'd had together making music in the bottom of the Grand Canyon? And what I wrote was this: I do not know, really, how we will survive without places like the inner gorge of the Grand Canyon to visit. Once in a lifetime, even, is enough to feel the stripping down, an ebb of the press of conventional time, a radical change of proportion, an unspoken respect for others that elicits keen emotional pleasure, a quick, intimate pounding of the heart. Some parts of the trip will emerge one day on an album. Others will be found in a gesture of friendship to some stranger in an airport, in a letter of outrage to a planner of dams, in a note of gratitude to a nameless face in the Park Service, in wondering at the relatives of the ubiquitous canyon wren, in the belief, passed on in whatever fashion, a photograph, a cord, a sketch, that nature can heal. The living of life, any life, involves great and private pain, much of which we share with no one. In such places as the inner gorge, the pain trails away from you. It is not so quiet there or so removed that you can hear yourself think, that you would even wish to. That comes later. You can hear your heart beat. That comes first.
Do you think that descriptions of what it's like to be, for instance, in the Grand Canyon are really good reminders for readers who are sitting at home, maybe in the city or maybe in the country, but far away from things of such natural wonder?
Well, you hope as a writer that they're good reminders. The only way I can really answer a question like that is to think about my own responsibilities or what I feel when I'm in the places that I'm really privileged to travel. I've chosen a kind of life that allows me to go to these places. And when I'm there, I think a great deal about the reader who, for reasons of timing or having to take care of children or all sorts of obligations that impinge on all our lives, can't be there. So I hope it's not just a reminder, but that in some real sense, as a writer, I am there paying attention for the reader. In other words, I'm looking at things that are not only just of interest to me, but of interest to what I think of as a community. So I would hope to do more than remind. I would hope that in what I see and in the way I'm able to put it together, to give the reader some sense of his or her own participation in that place, that it's not some distant geographic location to which they have no connection at all, a kind of an amusement or something at a distance, but something in which they have a personal stake.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that as the American landscape becomes more threatened, that this kind of writing becomes more important?
I do, but I think it's more than a kind of writing. What I see emerging in yes. in nonfiction is an attention to landscape, to the elements of landscape that we've known before in American fiction. It goes back a long ways, and we've known now in American nonfiction. But I sense. A very strong and substantial interest on the part of people who before this might not really have been that much interested in the elements of natural history, because they sense in them that for 40,000 years we've been telling ourselves stories about how to live worthy lives in the world, and the metaphors that we've chosen most consistently have been the metaphors of natural history. I think it's more than just a kind of writing. I think many writers are sort of turning to look at landscape and the movement of rivers, or at developments in business and things like that, and taking landscape into consideration in a way we haven't before, in part because we sense that it's not just physically imperiled. There's something else here. There's some kind of substantial, I guess you would say, a spiritual issue at stake. I think a number of writers have begun to notice this.
One thing that emerges over and over again in your latest collection of essays, Crossing Open Ground, is your willingness to challenge sanctimony and self-righteousness and to take on moral ambiguities. And one essay I'm thinking about is about a trip that you went on sailing with biologists who were killing seals for research, for important ecological research. Why don't you describe the research they were doing?
It was necessary to unravel, if you will, the food web in this area in the Chukchi Sea along the coast of Alaska, and having done that, to see how animals related to each other there, how the food chains operated, so that the information could be used to develop a plan for oil drilling, oil exploration and drilling. So you had this irony where you had to take the lives of animals in order to protect the lives, ultimately protect the lives of animals.
Did you have your mind made up before joining these researchers about whether or not this was justified killing?
I never have my mind made up. Life is too unfathomable and too complicated for any individual to stand up and say that he or she has it all figured out. And what I look at as my responsibility is to go into the face of things that on the surface seem wrong and horrible and deranged, and say, well, yes, of course they are, and it is heartbreaking that these animals are going to be killed, as we say, for science. But what is really going on here? If I can't determine that as a writer, if I can't expose what's really going on, then it makes it even more difficult for people who are not there to use that information to clarify these issues in a court of law or wherever it is that they wish to go. I don't think a reader comes to a writer in order to know what is right or wrong. I think the reader comes to the writer in order to learn what happened. My job is to say, I went to a place and I tried to pay attention to what was going on in all its detail, and this is what I saw, and then turn to the reader as a member of the community in which I live and say, is this what we want? Is this how we want our world to be?
You describe on this research boat that we were talking about, after the killing of seals, everybody kind of cleaning themselves off, bringing back
yes.
no traces of blood, because on the ship there would be people who
yes.
would be very offended by that. There were people who were willing to go along with the research, realizing that it was probably important and necessary,
yes.
but were very offended at the deaths, nevertheless, that were taking place. And I wonder how that decision was arrived at. You know, if that was something that the researchers were very conscious that they were doing, or is that something that you read into their actions?
No, it was something we all did. I mean, what happened was we were working off a research vessel, and some of the people on that research vessel, rumors had preceded us that these two researchers were going to be killing animals, and it was the rumors were as rumors can be, things were stretched all out of shape, and people had images of slaughter, and I spoke to some of those people, and I realized that they had very strong feelings about animals being killed for science, and I apprised my friends that I was with of that, and after that nobody said a thing, but we all, I mean, it was just unspoken that it would have been grossly disrespectful on our part to have left that ship and gone off in the ice and hunted and done our work and with these animals, taking stomach contents and measuring them and doing all that kind of work, and then to have come back to the ship with any trace of blood in our small boat or on our clothes would have been, it would have been inexcusably rude mm-hmm. to do that. And so that's why we, but nobody ever, neither of the, none of the three of us ever said a thing about it. It's just how you've got to behave with respect toward other human beings who don't have the same beliefs that you do.
My guess is writer Barry Lopez, who's best known for his book Arctic Dreams, which won a National Book Award in 1986. He has a recent collection of essays called Crossing Open Ground that will come out soon in paperback. In this recent collection of essays, you also write about watching the beached whales back in 1979
yes.
off the Oregon coast. And there were so many different kinds of people who had come to see the whales. And you write that there were ethical problems that beset the scientists, mystical considerations that occupied a lot of onlookers. But for the Parks Department, they had a real practical problem. How are they going to dispose of the dead whales?
Yes.
And the solution was they burned the whales. And
yes.
you describe a little bit of what that was like. And then you say that no novelists, no historians, no moral philosophers, no Melville scholars, no painters were there. Should they have been? I mean, would you
yes.
have liked for people like that to have been invited to
Absolutely.
Witness the burning of the whales?
Absolutely.
Why?
I think that all of the momentous events of our lives should be observed closely by a wide range of people. It is no longer sufficient for us just to send representatives of law enforcement agencies and journalists to the State Department of Government or whatever it is to witness these things. I am deeply suspicious of a government that cuts off, cuts its artists, for example, its dancers and its painters, as well as its intellectuals, its scholars, off from these kinds of experience. Now, on the other hand, I'd have to say that here you have a situation where 41 sperm whales have washed up on the coast of Oregon. They are, in the beginning, they're dying, and after several days, they're all dead. There's a health hazard here. There are all sorts of practical things that have to be solved, and the police really have no choice. They've got to limit the number of people that have access to the animals because we are also there are also fools and drunkards and irresponsible people among us who delight in torturing animals that are dying, and you've got to keep those people away. But it seems to me that we should at least think about in the context of these extraordinary events, the eruption of a volcano, the waging of war, that society ultimately benefits from a full range of minds addressing an issue like this, something that is this emotionally complicated. What I wanted to do in that story was, and it's a long piece in which I just wanted to stand very far in the background and interview the representatives of the different groups, the Park Service and the police and the scientists and, you know, the local people and whatnot, about what they thought about this. And part of what I was trying to say is that there is no best overall opinion, that if we're going to make good and sound decisions as a culture, we need to know more than just what we get in our newspapers and what we read in the police blotter and what our government officials tell us. It's not that those people are wrong, but that the message is not complete enough for us to make good decisions. I think now that you and I have talked about this a little bit, obviously something that is moving underneath our discussion is some kind of resolution with what we might call the other. When an animal like this, a huge sperm whale, washes up onto the coast of Oregon, you're face to face with a creature that lives, first of all, in a completely different environment than our terrestrial environment. And part of what I wanted to know is, how do we address the other? How do we address the strangeness of life? And in my travels with Eskimos and more recently traveling in Antarctica and northern Kenya and other places, that has been very much on my mind. How is it that we present ourselves to the other? How receptive are we to the thoughts or the feelings of the other, whether the other is a sperm whale or a Pintanjinjara, Aboriginal people in Australia, whoever it happens to be? How do we present ourselves? What draws me as a writer to these issues is, first of all, there is in my mind little or no separation between language and landscape. They're inextricably tied together. And language for me is a way to open up landscape and make clear in it the things that are really on the human mind. And those are the big questions. What is the relationship of the individual to God? What is the relationship of the individual to the state? What is the relationship of a man or a woman to his or her community? What are the responsibilities there? And as a writer, I find those things easiest to address in these metaphors that are my metaphors from childhood, which are natural history and anthropology and geography and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I think what I'm trying to do is the same thing writers have tried to do as far back as we go in Western history, and that is to find a way to present ourselves to the other, to that which is different from us, in such a way that we're not imposing our ideas, but proposing the best of what we have been able to develop in Western culture and offering it as a way of life. And in the same moment, creating an atmosphere in which the other can reach us, can propose to us, and in which we will listen to the other.
Barry, I'd like to ask you to read what I think is a very provocative paragraph from your epilogue of Arctic Dreams.
Yes. This comes in a passage in which I have been dealing with a problem that was very difficult for me, and that is trying to understand the hunting behavior of my host, these men I was traveling with from St. Lawrence Island. We were hunting walrus, and this is a kind of conclusion to some of those troubling thoughts that I had. No culture has yet solved the dilemma each has faced with the growth of a conscious mind, how to live a moral and compassionate existence when one is fully aware of the blood, the horror inherent in all life, when one finds darkness not only in one's own culture, but within oneself. If there is a stage at which an individual life becomes truly adult, it must be when one grasps the irony in its unfolding and accepts responsibility for a life lived in the midst of such paradox. One must live in the middle of contradiction, because if all contradiction were eliminated at once, life would collapse. There are simply no answers to some of the great persistent questions. You continue to live them out, making your life a worthy expression of a leaning into the light.
You know, I think that one of the things, in a way, you're getting at there is an argument to a simplistic notion that once ecology is restored, nature is good, people are good, mm-hmm. and things are simple and just. And your encounters with nature aren't like that at all. I mean, there are terrible paradoxes and really dark things that you encounter. And I guess what I'm interested in finding out is if your confrontations with the natural world have led from dark things that you recognized in yourself, or if you started to recognize those things in yourself more through your encounters with nature.
I'd be hard-pressed to answer the question, really, Terry. I think what happens, or what has happened to me, is that when I was a child, I spent a lot of time around animals and in the woods, and something I could never have articulated or even understood as a child was my sense that it was all right to feel that you fit there, that these things weren't exotic, they weren't the things of childhood, and that you dropped them and then became an adult. And as I grew older, and as I became in a formal sense a writer, that distance between myself as an individual and what we call the natural world, it never widened. And so when I stood in front of something that was terrifying, or I stood in front of something that was beautiful, there was no separation in my mind about what human beings are. I recognized in the natural world the quintessence of human life. They weren't separated.
You've written that freedom from dogma gives meaning to the world's celebration of life. That,
yes.
That you don't want to impose on wolves your impression of what wolves should be like. They'll teach you what they're really like, and
yes.
You will learn from that. Were you ever attached to dogma, though, when you started writing about nature?
I would think certainly. I mean, the disabuse of dogma is part of what your whole life is about. You
mm-hmm.
know, I think part of the social function of the writer in this country, certainly, and probably in other countries as well, is to undermine that complacency that comes with dogma, with the notion that it's all been figured out. It is an enormously difficult thing to do, to lead a human life. This is a terrifically difficult thing to do, and to lead a life with any kind of grace, and the trouble that people have in their lives to strive to be worthy in their own eyes and in the eyes of their community. This is an incredibly difficult thing to do. And sooner or later you realize that this dogmatic notion that this is that everything is black and white is just, it just doesn't work.
You've talked about the difficulty everybody has of living with any grace.
Yes.
And you live in the woods yourself. And I was wondering if that has made it easier for you to live with that sense of grace.
I don't think so. In fact, I think it's been more troubling for me, really. I, like many writers, I lived in a relatively quiet existence for a long time, and I had an intimacy with the landscape in Oregon where I live, and I came and went there on a regular basis, and I knew a great deal about the woods around my home. And then as I was drawn away, I went up north for long periods of time to work on a book which eventually became Arctic Dreams. And at the moment, most of the time, I'm very far away from here, in Antarctica, for example, or in northern Kenya. So I don't spend very much time at home, and that's begun to trouble me. And I've begun to wonder about exactly where I'm rooted. And I think of my life actually as somewhat less graceful than I would like it to be, because I am such an itinerant at the moment. This is a period of time that has something to do with a book and will go on for several more years, but I don't feel that I move very gracefully in the world at the moment, because I'm away from my community, I'm away from home for long periods of time.
When you're traveling, for instance, with Eskimos, as you've done a lot over the years, do they ever say to you or convey to you that you think too much, that you're too moody.
Sure. Uh-huh. Not that I'm moody. I remember one time this man put his arm around my shoulder and he says to me, you're always thinking. And it wasn't a compliment. What he was saying to me was, your mind is so actively engaged on a rational and analytic plane that you miss a lot of what is going on because you're too busy thinking about it. And that man taught me to just, in a sense, put my notebook down and become fully immersed in the place. He said, Barry, you're always talking about how necessary it is to pay attention, and you've got to pay even more attention than you think if you're going to see what's going on.
Mm-hmm. When you're out on a long trip, and things are getting very physically uncomfortable, you're very cold, or you don't have enough food, or the kind of food that you'd really like, and maybe you were wishing you were actually home. Does that discomfort ever distract you from your larger goals, the ideas that you've been telling us about?
Oh, yes.
Are you always able to keep in touch with the larger meaning that you're looking for?
No, I'm just as human as anyone else, and I have there's nights when the mosquitoes are tearing you apart and you can't sleep, or there are nights when it's so bloody cold you can't sleep, and you get very tired, exhausted, and there's nothing to do but go on. I mean, I've been in situations where it's so cold that everyone has thought the same thought. I hope nobody brought a thermometer, because if we knew how cold it was, it would be so depressing, it would be even more difficult to do what we're trying to do. But I guess during the day sometime I try to, as a matter of ritual, in the same way you would keep a journal, I try to focus every day on my responsibilities, and even if I just get a few shreds out of it, to overcome the discomforts. I would also add that, you know, these what we're talking about are really abstract notions. And the reader, in the end, doesn't care about, I think, these abstract notions of the other and and ideas about that have certain political overtones or are about environmental problems. The reader only wants one thing. The reader wants a wonderful story. And if you can't tell the reader a wonderful story, then you're not writing. So when I'm traveling, what I'm thinking about primarily 99% of the time is the elements of a story. How can I make a story come out of this? And then if there's anything worth listening to on my mind, you know, as just another man or woman walking down the street, if there's anything that's really worth listening to, I won't be able to get it out of the story. It'll be buried in there. And that's the magic of that wild animal that we call the language. But when I'm in a state of discomfort when I'm traveling, I'm thinking that the thing I must do above all else is pay attention to the simple particulars of daily life, the temperature, the movement of air, the color of stones, the tone of voice when you hear one man speaking Swahili and another man speaking Turkana, and how they interact with each other, and what are the smells of these particular leaves, and how hot does this sand feel on the back of your wrist, and what is the color of that mountain that disappears into the same color of sky, and where's the line of differentiation? Those are the things that I think about, because if I don't have that, if I can't tell a reader what it was like, if I can't say to the reader, this is what happened, then the rest of it is just kind of philosophical speculation that doesn't fit anywhere in a real life.
Where are you off to next?
Where am I off to next? I'm going to the island of San Salvador in the Bahamas to dive, and then I'm going back to Galapagos to work on some material down there, and then I'm going back to the Northern Territory in Australia.
Well, I want to thank you so much for sharing some of your thoughts with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, dear.